Simon & Schuster Audio presents In 5 Years, a novel by Rebecca Searle. Read by Megan Hilty.
For Layla Sales, who has lit up the last 5 years, and the five before them. We dreamed it because it had already happened. The future is the one thing you can count on not abandoning you, kid, he'd said. The future always finds you. Stand still and it will find you, the way the land just has to run to the sea. Marianne Wiggins, Evidence of Things Unseen. Coming over the bridge to Manhattan, Pi, Nora Ephron. Chapter 1. 25. That's the number I count to every morning before I even open my eyes. It's a meditative calming technique that helps your brain with memory, focus, and attention. But the real reason I do it is because that's how long it takes my boyfriend David to get out of bed next to me and flip the coffee maker on, and for me to smell the beans. 36. That's how many minutes it takes me to brush my teeth, shower, and put on face toner, serum, cream, makeup, and a suit for work. If I wash my hair, it's 43. 18. That's the walk to work in minutes from our Murray Hill apartment to East 47th Street, where the law offices of Sutter, Boyd, and Barn are located. 24. That's how many months I believe you should be dating someone before you move in with them. 28. The right age to get engaged. 30. The right age to get married. My name is Danny Cohan, and I believe in living by numbers. Happy interview day, David says when I walk into the kitchen. Today, December 15th, I'm wearing a bathrobe, hair spun up into a towel. He's still in his pajamas, and his brown hair has a significant amount of salt and pepper for someone who has not yet crossed 30. But I like it. It makes him look dignified, particularly when he wears glasses, which he often does. Thank you, I say. I wrap my arms around him, kiss his neck, and then his lips. I've already brushed my teeth, but David never has morning breath, ever. When we first started dating, I thought he was getting up out of bed before me to swoosh some toothpaste in there, but when we moved in together, I realized it's just his natural state. He wakes up that way. The same cannot be said of me. Coffee's ready. He squints at me, and my heart tugs at the look on his face. The way it scrunches all up when he's trying to pay attention but doesn't have his contacts in yet. He takes a mug down and then pours. I go to the refrigerator, and when he hands me the cup, I add a dollop of creamer. Coffee mate, hazelnut. David thinks it's sacrilegious, but he buys it to indulge me. This is the kind of man he is. Judgmental and generous. I take the coffee cup and go sit in our kitchen nook that overlooks Third Avenue. Murray Hill isn't the most glamorous neighborhood in New York, and it gets a bad rap. Every Jewish fraternity and sorority kid in the tri-state area moves here after graduation. The average street style is a Penn sweatshirt. But there's nowhere else in the city where we'd be able to afford a two-bedroom with a full kitchen in a doorman building. And between the two of us, we make more money than a pair of 28-year-olds has any right to. David works in finance as an investment banker at Tishman Speyer, a real estate conglomerate. I'm a corporate lawyer. And today, I have an interview at the top law firm in the city, Wachtell. The Mecca. The pinnacle. The mythological headquarters that sits in a black and gray fortress on West 52nd Street. The top lawyers in the country all work there. The client list is unfathomable. They represent everyone. Boeing, ING, AT&T, all of the biggest corporate mergers. The deals that determine the vicissitudes of our global markets happen within their walls. I've wanted to work at Wachtell since I was 10 years old, and my father used to take me into the city for lunch at Serendipity and a matinee. We'd pass all the big buildings in Times Square, and then I'd insist we walk to 51 West 52nd Street so I could gaze up at the CBS building, where Wachtell has historically had its offices since 1965. You're going to kill it today, babe, David says. He stretches his arms overhead, revealing a slice of stomach. David is tall and lanky. All of his t-shirts are too small when he stretches, which I welcome. You ready? Of course. When this interview first came up, I thought it was a joke. A headhunter calling me from Wachtell. Yeah, right. Bella, my best friend, and the proverbial surprise-obsessed flighty blonde must have paid someone off. But no, it was for real. Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen, and Katz wanted to interview me. Today, December 15th. I marked the date in my planner in Sharpie. Nothing was going to erase this. Don't forget we're going to dinner to celebrate tonight, David says. I won't know if I got the job today, I tell him. That's not how interviews work. Really? Explain it to me then. He's flirting with me. David is a great flirt. You wouldn't think it, he's so buttoned up most of the time, but he has a great, witty mind. It's one of the things I love most about him. It was one of the things that first attracted me to him. I raise my eyebrows at him, and he downshifts. Of course you'll get the job. It's in your plan. I appreciate your confidence. I don't push him because I know what tonight is. David is terrible with secrets and an even worse liar. Tonight, on this, the second month of my 28th year, David Andrew Rosen is going to propose to me. Two Raisin Bran scoops, half a banana, he asks. He's holding out a bowl to me. Big days are bagel days, I say. Whitefish, you know that. Before we find out about a big case, I always stop at Sarge's on 3rd Avenue. Their whitefish salad rivals Katz's downtown, and the wait, even with a line, is never more than 4.5 minutes. I revel in their efficiency. Make sure you bring gum, David says, sliding in next to me. I bat my eyes and take a sip of coffee. It goes down sweet and warm. You're here late, I tell him. I've just realized. He should have been gone hours ago. He works market hours. It occurs to me he might not be going to the office at all today. Maybe he still has to pick up the ring. I thought I'd see you off. He flips his watch over. It's an Apple. I got it for him on our 2-year anniversary 4 months ago. But I should jet. I was going to work out. David never works out. He has a monthly membership to Equinox I think he's used maybe twice in 2.5 years. He's naturally lean and runs sometimes on the weekends. The wasted expense is a point of contention between us, so I don't bring it up this morning. I don't want anything to get in the way of today, and certainly not this early. Sure, I say. I'm gonna get ready. But you have time. David pulls me toward him and threads a hand into the collar of my robe. I let it linger for 1, 2, 3, 4. I thought you were late, and I can't lose focus. He nods, kisses me. He gets it. In that case, we're doubling up tonight, he says. Don't tease me, I pinch his biceps. My cell phone is ringing where it sits plugged in on my nightstand in the bedroom, and I follow the noise. The screen fills with a photo of a blue-eyed, blonde-haired Shiksa goddess, sticking her tongue sideways at the camera. Bella. I'm surprised. My best friend is only awake before noon if she's been up all night. Good morning, I tell her. Where are you? Not New York. She yawns. I imagine her stretching on some seaside terrace, a silk kimono pooling around her. Not New York. Paris, she says. Well, that explains her ability to speak at this hour. I thought you were leaving this evening. I have her flight on my phone. UA 57, leaves Newark at 6:40 p.m. I went early, she says. Dad wanted to do dinner tonight just to bitch about Mom, clearly. She pauses and I hear her sneeze. What are you doing today? Does she know about tonight? David would have told her, I think, but she's also bad at keeping secrets, especially for me. Big day for work, and then we're going to dinner. Right, dinner, she says. She definitely knows. I put the phone on speaker and shake out my hair. It will take me 7 minutes to blow it dry. I check the clock. 8:57 a.m. Plenty of time. The interview isn't until 11. I almost tried you 3 hours ago. Well, that would have been early. But you'd still pick up, she says, lunatic. Bella knows I leave my phone on all night. Bella and I have been best friends since we were 7 years old. Me, nice Jewish girl from the main line of Philadelphia. Her, French-Italian princess, whose parents threw her a 13th birthday party big enough to stop any bat mitzvah in its tracks. Bella is spoiled, mercurial, and more than a little bit magical. It's not just me. Everywhere she goes, people fall at her feet. She is the easiest to love and gives love freely. But she's fragile, too. A membrane of skin stretches so thinly over her emotions, it's always threatening to burst. Her parents' bank account is large and easily accessible, but their time and attention are not. Growing up, she practically lived at my house. It was always the two of us. Bells, I gotta go. I have that interview today. That's right, Watchmen. Wachtel. What are you gonna wear? Probably a black suit. I always wear a black suit. I'm already mentally thumbing through my closet, even though I've had the suit chosen since they called me. How thrilling, she deadpans. And I imagine her scrunching up her small, pin nose like she just smelled something unsavory. When are you back? I asked. Probably Tuesday, she says, but I don't know, Ronaldo might meet me, in which case we'd go to the Riviera for a few days. You wouldn't think it, but it's great this time of year. No one is around. You have the whole place to yourself. Ronaldo. I haven't heard his name in a beat. I think he was before Francesco, the pianist, and after Marcus, the filmmaker. Bella is always in love. Always. But her romances, while intense and dramatic, never last more than a few months. She rarely, if ever, calls someone her boyfriend. I think the last one might have been when we were in college. And what of Jacques? Have fun, I say. Text me when you land and send me pictures, especially of Ronaldo. For my files, you know. Yes, Mom. Love you, I say. Love you more. I blow dry my hair and keep it down, running a flat iron over the hairline and the ends so it doesn't frizz up. I put on small pearl stud earrings my parents gave me for my college graduation and my favorite Movado watch David bought me for Hanukkah last year. My chosen black suit, fresh from the dry cleaners, hangs on the back of my closet door. When I put it on, I add a red and white ruffled shirt underneath, in Bella's honor. A little spark of detail, or life, as she would say. I come back into the kitchen and give a little spin. David's made little to no progress on getting dressed or leaving. He's definitely taking the day off. What do we think? I ask him. You're hired, he says. He puts a hand on my hip and gives me a light kiss on the cheek. I smile at him. That's the plan, I say. Sarge's is predictably empty at 10 a.m. It's a morning commute place, so it only takes 2 minutes and 40 seconds for me to get my whitefish bagel. I eat it walking. Sometimes I stand at the counter table at the window. There are no stools, but there's usually room to stash my bag. The city is all dressed up for the holidays. The street lamps lit, the windows frosted. It's 31 degrees out, practically balmy by New York winter standards. And it hasn't snowed yet, which makes walking in heels a breeze. So far, so good. I arrive at Wachtel's headquarters at 10:45 a.m. My stomach starts working against me, and I toss the rest of the bagel. This is it. The thing I've worked the last 6 years for. Well, really, the thing I've worked the last 18 years for. Every SAT prep test, every history class, every hour studying for the LSAT, the countless 2 a.m. nights, every time I've been chewed out by a partner for something I didn't do, every time I've been chewed out by a partner for something I did do, every single piece of effort has been leading me to and preparing me for this one moment. I pop a piece of gum. I take a deep breath and enter the building. 51 West 52nd Street is giant, but I know exactly what door I need to enter and what security desk I need to check in at. The entrance on 52nd, the desk right in front. I've rehearsed this chain of events so many times in my head, like a ballet. First the door, then the pivot, then a sachet to the left, and a quick succession of steps. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. The elevator doors open to the 33rd floor, and I suck in my breath. I can feel the energy like candy to the vein as I look around at the people moving in and out of the glass-doored conference rooms like extras on the show Suits, hired for today, for me, for my viewing pleasure alone. The place is in full bloom. I get the feeling that you could walk in here at any hour, any day of the week, and this is what you would see. Midnight on Saturday, Sunday at 8 a.m. It's a world out of time, functioning on its own schedule. This is what I want. This is what I've always wanted. To be somewhere that stops at nothing. To be surrounded by the pace and rhythm of greatness.
Ms. Cohan?
A young woman greets me where I stand. She wears a Banana Republic sheath dress, no blazer. She's a receptionist. I know because all lawyers are required to wear suits at Wachtell.
Right this way.
Thank you so much. She leads me around the bullpen. I spot the corners, the offices, on full display. Glass and wood and chrome. The thump, thump, thump of money. She leads me into a conference room with a long mahogany table. On it sits a glass tumbler of water and three glasses. I take in this subtle and revealing piece of information. There are going to be two partners in here for the interview, not one. It's good, of course. It's fine. I know my stuff forward and backward. I could practically draw a floor plan of their offices for them. I've got this. 2 minutes stretch to 5 minutes, stretch to 10. The receptionist is long gone. I'm contemplating pouring myself a glass of water when the door opens and in walks Miles Aldridge, first in his class at Harvard, Yale Law Journal, and a senior partner at Wachtell. He's a legend, and now he's in the same room as me. I inhale. Ms. Cohan, he says, so glad you could make this date work. Naturally, Mr. Aldridge, I say, it's a pleasure to meet you. He raises his eyebrows at me. He's impressed I know his name, sight unseen. 3 points. Shall we? He gestures for me to sit, and I do. He pours us each a glass of water. The other one sits there, untouched. So, he says, let's begin. Tell me a little bit about yourself. I work through the answers I've practiced, honed, and sculpted over the last few days. From Philadelphia, my father owned a lighting business, and when I was not even 10 years old, I helped him with contracts in the back office. In order to sort and file to my heart's content, I had to read into them a bit, and I fell in love with the organization, the way language, the pure truth in the words, was non-negotiable. It was like poetry, but poetry with outcome, poetry with concrete meaning, with actionable power. I knew it was what I wanted to do. I went to Columbia Law and graduated second in my class. I clerked for the Southern District of New York before accepting the reality of what I'd always known, which is that I wanted to be a corporate lawyer. I wanted to practice a kind of law that is high stakes, dynamic, incredibly competitive, and yes, offers me the opportunity to make a lot of money. Why? Because it's what I was born to do, what I have trained for, and what has led me here today to the place I always knew I'd be, the Golden Gates, their headquarters. We go through my resume point by point. Aldridge is surprisingly thorough, which is to my benefit, as it gives me more time to express my accomplishments. He asks me why I think I'd be a good fit, what kind of work culture I gravitate toward. I tell him that when I stepped off the elevator and saw all the endless movement, all the frenzied bustle, I felt as if I were home. It's not hyperbole, and he can tell. He chuckles. It's aggressive, he says, and endless, as you say. Many spin out. I cross my hands on the table. I can assure you, I tell him, that won't be a problem here. And then he asks me the proverbial question, the one you always prepare for because they always ask, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I inhale and then give him my airtight answer. Not just because I've practiced, which I have, but because it's true. I know. I always have. I'll be working here at Wachtell as a senior associate. I'll be the most requested in my year on M&A cases. I'm incredibly thorough and incredibly efficient. I'm like an X-Acto knife. I'll be up for junior partner. And outside of work? I'll be married to David. We'll be living in Gramercy Park, on the park. We'll have a kitchen we love and enough table space for two computers. We'll go to the Hamptons every summer, the Berkshires occasionally on weekends. When I'm not in the office, of course. Aldridge is satisfied. I've cinched it, I can tell. We shake hands and the receptionist is back, ushering me through the offices and to the elevators that deliver me once again to the land of the mortals. The third glass was just to throw me off. Good shot. After the interview, I go downtown to Reformation, one of my favorite clothing stores in Soho. I took the day off from work and it's only lunchtime. Now that the interview is over, I can turn my attention to tonight, to what's coming. When David told me he had made a reservation at the Rainbow Room, I immediately knew what it meant. We had talked about getting engaged. I knew it would be this year, but I'd thought it would have happened this past summer. The holidays are crazy, and the winter is David's busy time at work. But he knows how much I love the city and lights, so it's happening tonight. "Welcome to Reformation," the sales girl says. She's wearing black wide-legged pants and a tight white turtleneck. "What can I help you with?" "I'm getting engaged tonight," I say, "and I need something to wear." She looks confused for half a second. Then her face brightens. "How exciting," she says. "Let's look around. What are you thinking?" I take barrels into the dressing room. Skirts and low-back dresses and a pair of red crepe pants with a matching loose camisole. I put the red outfit on first. And when I do, it's perfect. Dramatic, but still classy. Serious, but with a little edge. I look at myself in the mirror. I hold out my hand. Today, I think. Tonight. Chapter 2. The Rainbow Room is located on the 65th floor of 30 Rockefeller Plaza. It boasts one of the highest restaurant views in Manhattan, and from its magnificent windows and terraces, you can see the Chrysler Building and the Empire State Building floating amongst the city skyline. David knows I'm a sucker for a view. On one of our first dates, he took me to an event at the top of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. They were showing some Richard Serra pieces on the roof, and the sunlight made the giant bronze sculptures look like they were on fire. That was 2.5 years ago now, and he never forgot how much I loved it. The Rainbow Room is usually closed for private events only, but they open their dining room during the week to select clientele. Because Tishman Speyer, where David works, owns and manages the Rainbow Room and the underlying real estate, these reservations are first made available to employees. Usually they're impossible to get, but for a proposal. David greets me at Bar 65, a cocktail lounge adjacent to the restaurant. The terraces are now covered, so even though it's reaching frigid temperatures outside, people can still take advantage of the superb view. Under the guise of David coming from the office, we decided to meet there. He wasn't home when I came back to change, and I can only assume he was running last-minute errands or taking a walk to ward off nerves. David is wearing a suit, navy, with a white shirt and a pink and blue tie. The Rainbow Room is, of course, jacket required. "You look very handsome," I say. I take off my coat and hand it to him, revealing my fire engine red ensemble. Bold for me in color. He whistles. "And you look very incredible," he says. He hands my coat to a passing porter. "Would you like a drink?" He fidgets with his tie, and I understand, of course, that he is nervous. It's endearing. Additionally, he seems to be sweating at his hairline. He definitely walked here. "Sure," I say. We sidle up to the bar. We order 2 glasses of champagne. We toast. David just stares at me, wide-eyed. "To the future," I say. David downs half a glass. "Oh, I can't believe I didn't ask," he says. He brushes the back of his hand against his lips. "How did it go?" "I nailed it." I set my glass down triumphantly. "It was honestly butter. It couldn't have gone better. Aldridge was the one who interviewed me. No shit. What's their time frame? He said they'd let me know by Tuesday. If I get the job, I'd start after the holidays. David takes another sip. He puts his hand on my waist and squeezes. I'm so proud of you. One step closer. That 5-year plan I expressed to Aldridge isn't just mine. It's ours. We came up with it 6 months into dating, when it was obvious this thing between us was serious. David will transition out of investment banking and begin working at a hedge fund. More opportunity for big money, less corporate bureaucracy. We didn't even argue about where we want to live. It's always been Gramercy for both of us. The rest was a fluid negotiation. We never came to an impasse. Indeed. Mr. Rosen, your table is ready. There is a man in white tails at our backs, ushering us out of the bar, down the hallway, and into the ballroom. I've only ever seen the Rainbow Room in movies, but it's magnificent. Truly the perfect place to get engaged. Round tables sit gracefully in tiers around a circular dance floor where a dazzling chandelier hangs overhead. Rumors are the dance floor rotates, a spinning circle in the center of the room. Ornate floral arrangements reminiscent of a wedding pepper the dining room. There is a festive old-world holiday air. Women in fur, gloves, diamonds, the smell of good leather. It's beautiful, I breathe. David squeezes me to his side and kisses my cheek. We're celebrating, he says. A server holds a chair back for me. I sit. A white napkin is produced in a flourish and eased onto my lap. The slow, smooth styles of Frank Sinatra float over the dining room. A singer croons in the corner. This is too much, I say. What I mean is that it's perfect. It's exactly right. He knows this. That's why he's him. I wouldn't say I'm a romantic, exactly, but I believe in romance, which is to say, I believe in calling to inquire about a date instead of texting, and flowers after sex, and Frank Sinatra at an engagement, and New York City in December. We order champagne again, this time a bottle. Momentarily, my chest ticks at what tonight will cost. Don't think about it, David says, reading me. I love that about him, that he always knows what I'm thinking because we're always on the same page. The bubbles arrive, cool and sweet and crisp. Our second glasses go down easy. Should we dance? David asks me. On the floor, I see two couples swaying to All the Way. Through the good or lean years, and for all the in-between years. Suddenly, I think that David may grab the mic. He may make this public. He is not a showy person by nature, but he is confident and unafraid of public displays. I am unnerved at this possibility of the ring arriving in my chocolate souffle and his getting down on one knee for all the world to see. You want to dance? I ask him. David hates dancing. I have to drag him at weddings. He thinks he has no rhythm, and he's right. But so few guys have rhythm that it really doesn't matter. There are no wrong moves to PYT except sitting down. Why not? He says. We're here. He offers me his hand, and I take it. As we make our way down the steps to the rotunda, the song switches. It Had to Be You. David takes me in his arms. The two other couples, older, smile in approval. You know, David says, I love you. I do, I say. I mean, you'd better. Is this it? Is this when he drops? But he keeps just moving me slowly around the rotating rotunda. The song ends. A few people clap. We go back to our seats. I feel suddenly disappointed. Could I be wrong? We order. A simple salad, the lobster, wine. The ring is neither perched on the lobster's claw nor drowning in a glass of Bordeaux. We both move our food around on our plates with lovely silver forks, barely eating. David, usually chatty, has a hard time focusing. More than once, he knocks and writes his water glass. Just do it, I want to tell him. I'll say yes. Perhaps I should spell it out with cherry tomatoes. Finally, dessert arrives. Chocolate souffle, creme brulee, pavlova. He's ordered one of everything, but there is no ring affixed to any of their powdered tops. When I look up, David is gone, because he's holding the box in his hands right by my seat where he kneels. David. He shakes his head. For once, don't talk, okay? Just let me get through this. People around us murmur in quiet. Some of the surrounding tables have phones aimed at us. Even the music lowers. David, there are people watching. But I'm smiling. Finally. Danny, I love you. I know neither one of us is a particularly sentimental person, and I don't tell you this stuff a lot, but I want you to know that our relationship isn't just part of some plan for me. I think you're extraordinary, and I want to build this life with you. Not because we're the same, but because we fit. And because the more time goes on, the more I cannot imagine my life taking place without you. Yes, I say. He smiles. I think maybe you should let me ask the question. Someone close breaks out in laughter. I'm sorry, I say. Please ask. Danielle Ashley Cohan, will you marry me? He opens the box and inside is a cushion-cut diamond flanked by two triangular stones set in a simple platinum band. It's modern, clean, elegant. It's exactly me. You can answer now, he tells me. Yes, I say. Absolutely. Yes. He reaches up and kisses me, and the dining room breaks out in applause. I hear the snaps of lenses, the oohs and ahs of generous goodwill from surrounding patrons. David takes the ring out of the box and slides it onto my finger. It takes a second to waddle over my knuckle. My hands are swollen from the champagne. But when it does, it sits there like it has always been there. A waiter appears out of thin air with a bottle of something. Compliments of the chef, he says. Congratulations. David sits back down. He holds my hand across the table. I marvel at the ring, turning my palm back and forth in the candlelight. David, I say, it's gorgeous. He smiles. It looks good on you. Did you pick this out? Bella helped, he says. I was worried she was going to ruin the surprise. You know her. She's terrible at keeping anything from you. I smile. I squeeze his hand. He's right about that, but I don't need to tell him. That's the thing about relationships. It's not necessary to say everything. I had no idea, I say. I'm sorry it was so public, he says, gesturing around us. I couldn't resist. This place is practically begging for it. David, I say. I look at him, my future husband. I want you to know I'd suffer through 10 more public proposals if it meant I got to marry you. No, you wouldn't, he says. But you can convince me of anything, and it's one of the things I love about you. 2 hours later, we're home. Hungry and buzzing off champagne and wine, we crouch around the computer ordering Thai food from Spice Online. This is us. Spend $700 on dinner, come home to eat $8 fried rice. I never want that to change. I want to put on sweatpants, per usual, but something tells me not to. Not tonight. Not yet. If I were different, someone else, Bella, for example, I'd have lingerie to wear. I'd have bought some this week. I'd put on a matching bra and underwear and hover by the door. Fuck the pad thai. But then I probably wouldn't be engaged to David right now. We're not big drinkers, and the champagne and wine have gotten to both of us. I edge myself farther onto the couch. I put my feet in David's lap. He squeezes the arch of my foot, kneading the tender place my heels are unkind to. I feel the buzzing in my stomach move upward to my head, until my eyes are being pulled closed like blinds. I yawn. Within a minute, I'm asleep. Chapter 3. I wake up slowly. How long have I been asleep? I roll over and look at the clock on the nightstand. 10:59 p.m. I stretch my legs. Did David move me to bed? The sheets feel crisp and cool around me, and I weigh just closing my eyes again and drifting back to sleep. But then I'd miss this, our engagement night, and I force them open. We still have more champagne to drink, and we need to have sex. That's a thing you should do on the night you get engaged. I yawn, blinking, and then sit up, my breath exiting my body in a rush. Because I'm not in our bed. I'm not even in our apartment. I'm wearing a formal dress, red, beaded around the neckline. And I'm somewhere I've never been before. I could tell you I think I'm dreaming, but I don't. Not really. I can feel my legs and arms and the frenetic beating of my own uneasy heart. Was I kidnapped? I take in my surroundings. On further glance, I realize I'm in a loft apartment. The bed I'm in is flush up against floor-to-ceiling windows that appear to orient me in Long Island City. I look out, desperate for some anchoring image, and then I spot the Empire State Building, rising out of the water in the distance. I'm in Brooklyn, but where? I can see the New York City skyline across the river and, to the right, the Manhattan Bridge, which means I'm in Dumbo. I must be. Did David take me to a hotel? I see a red brick building across the street with a brown barn door. There's a party happening inside. I can see camera flashes and lots of flowers. A wedding, maybe. The apartment isn't giant, but it gives the illusion of space. Two blue velvet chairs sit necking in front of a glass and steel coffee table. An orange dresser perches at the foot of the bed, and colorful Persian rugs make the open space feel cozy, if not a little cluttered. There are exposed pipes and wood beams and a print on the wall. It's an eye chart that reads, "I was young, I needed the money." Where the hell am I? I hear him before I see him. He calls.
Are you awake?
I freeze. Should I hide? Make a run for it? I see a large steel door across the apartment in the direction of where the voice is coming from. If I bolt, I might be able to get it open before... He rounds the corner from what must be the kitchen. He's dressed in black dress pants and a blue and black striped shirt, unbuttoned at the top. My eyes go wide. I want to scream. I might. The well-dressed stranger comes over to me, and I leap onto the other side of the bed by the windows.
Hey, he says. Are you okay?
No, I say. No, I'm not. He sighs. He does not seem surprised by my response. You fell asleep. He runs his hand back and forth across his forehead. I notice he has a scar, crooked, over his left eye. What are you doing here? I've backed myself so far into a corner I'm practically pushed up against the windows. Come on, he says. Do you know me? He bends one knee onto the bed. Danny, he says. Are you really asking me that? He knows my name. And there's something about the way he says it that makes me pause. Take a breath. He says it like he's said it before. I don't know, I say. I don't know where I am. It was a good night, he says, wasn't it? I look down at my dress. I realize for the first time it's one I already own. My mom and I bought it with Bella on a shopping trip 3 years ago. Bella has the same one in white. Yeah, I say without even thinking, as if I know, as if I were there. What is happening? And that's when I catch the TV. It has been on this whole time, the volume low. It's hanging on the wall opposite the bed, and it's playing the news. On the screen is a small graphic with the date and time. December 15th, 2025. A man in a blue suit is prattling on about the weather, a snow cloud swaying behind him. I try to breathe.
What? He says. Do you want me to turn it off?
I shake my head. The response is automatic, and I watch him as he walks to the coffee table and grabs the remote. As he goes, he untucks his shirt.
Weather warning for the East Coast as a blizzard heads toward us. Possibility of 6 inches overnight with continued accumulation into Tuesday.
2025. It's not possible. Of course it's not. 5 years.
This must be some kind of prank.
Bella. When we were younger, she used to pull shit like this all the time. Once for my 11th birthday, she figured out how to get a pony into my backyard without my parents knowing. We woke up to it playing chicken with the swing set.
But even Bella couldn't get a fake date and time on national television. Could she? And who is this guy? Oh my God, David.
The man in the apartment turns around.
Hey, he says, are you hungry?
At his question, my stomach rumbles. I barely ate at dinner, and wherever I am in whatever parallel universe with David, the pad thai has most certainly not yet arrived.
No, I say.
He cocks his head to the side.
Kinda sounds like you are.
I'm not, I insist. I need
some food, he says.
He smiles. I wonder how wide the window's open. I slowly come around the bed.
Do you want to change first?
He asks me. I start, but I don't know how to finish the sentence because I don't know where we are, where I would even find clothes.
I follow him into a closet. It's a walk-in right off the bedroom alcove. There are rows of bags and shoes and clothes hanging, organized by color. I know right away, this is my closet, which means this is my apartment. I live here.
I moved to Dumbo, I say out loud.
The man laughs. Then he opens a drawer near the center of the closet and pulls out a pair of sweatpants and a t-shirt, and my heart stops.
They're his. He lives here too. We're together.
David. I reel back and run for the bathroom. I find it to the left of the living room. I close the door and bolt it. I splash some cold water on my face.
Think, Danny, think.
Inside the bathroom are all the products I love. ABBA body cream and tea tree oil shampoo. I dab some Michelle serum on my face, comforted by the smell, the familiarity. On the back of the door hangs a bathrobe with my initials, one I've had forever. Also, there are a pair of drawstring black pajama pants and an old Columbia sweatshirt. I take off the dress. I put them both on. I run some rosehip oil over my lips and unlock the door.
We have pasta or pasta, the man calls from the kitchen.
First things first, I need to find out this guy's name. His wallet. David and I have a 60-40 split when it comes to our finances, based on the income discrepancy between us. We decided this after we moved in together and haven't changed it since. I have never once looked inside his wallet except for one unfortunate incident involving a new knife and his insurance card.
Pasta sounds good, I say.
I go back near the bed to where his pants hang half off a chair, trailing to the floor. I glance toward the kitchen and check the pockets. I pull out his wallet. Old leather, indistinguishable brand. I rifle through it. He doesn't look up from filling a pot with water. I pull out two business cards, one to a dry cleaner, the other a Stumptown punch card. Then I find his license, Aaron Gregory, 33 years old. His license is New York State, and he's 6 foot and has green eyes. I put everything back where I found it.
Do you want red sauce or pesto? He asks from the kitchen.
Aaron?
I try.
He smiles.
Yes?
Pesto, I say. I walk toward the kitchen. It's 2025. A man I've never met is my boyfriend, and I live in Brooklyn.
Pesto is what I wanted, too.
I sit down at the counter. There are cherry wood stools with wire-framed backs I don't recognize and don't particularly like. I take him in. He's blonde with green eyes and a jaw that makes him look like one of the superhero Chris's. He's hot. Too hot for me, to be totally honest with you. And evidently, based on his looks and his name, not Jewish. I feel my stomach twist. This is what becomes of me in 5 years? I'm dating a golden Adonis in an artist's loft? Oh God, does my mother know? The water boils and he pours the pasta into the pot. Steam rises up and he steps back, wiping his forehead.
Am I still a lawyer? I ask suddenly.
Aaron looks at me and laughs.
Of course, he says.
Wine? I nod, exhaling a sigh of relief. So some things have gotten off track, but not all.
I can work with this. I just have to find David, figure out what happened there, and we'll be back in business. Still a lawyer. Hallelujah. When the noodles are cooked, he drains them and tosses them back into the pot with the pesto and Parmesan, and all of a sudden, I am dizzy with hunger. All I can think about right now is the food. Aaron takes two wine glasses down from a cabinet, moving expertly around the kitchen. My kitchen. Our kitchen. He pours me a glass of red and hands it over the counter. It's big and bold. A Brunello, maybe. Not something I'd usually buy. Dinner is served. Aaron hands me a giant steaming bowl of spaghetti and pesto. And before he even comes back around the counter, I'm shoveling a forkful into my mouth. It occurs to me mid-bite that this could all be some kind of government science play and he could be poisoning me, but I'm too hungry to stop or care. The pasta is delicious, warm and salty, and I don't look up for another 5 minutes. When I do, he's staring at me. I wipe my mouth with my napkin. Sorry, I say. I feel like I haven't eaten in years. He nods and pushes back his plate. So now we have two choices. We can just get drunk, or we can get drunk and place categories. I love board games, which of course he would know. David is more of a card guy. He taught me how to play bridge and rummy. He thinks board games are childish, and that if we're playing something, we should be strengthening our brain pathways, which both bridge and rummy do. Get drunk, I say. Aaron gives my arm an affectionate squeeze. I feel like his hand is still there when he lets go. There is something strange here, some strange pull, some emotion that begins to expand in the room, fill up the corners. Aaron tops off our wine glasses. We leave our plates where they sit on the counter. Now what? And then I realize he's going to want to get into bed. This boyfriend of mine, he's going to want to touch me. I can just feel it. I make a beeline for one of the blue velvet chairs and take a seat. He looks at me sideways. Huh? All at once, something occurs to me. I look down at my hand, panicked. There on my finger is an engagement ring. It's a solitaire canary diamond with tiny stones around it. It's vintage and whimsical. Not the ring David gave me tonight. It's not anything I'd ever pick out, yet here it is on my finger. Shit, 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 shit. I bolt up from the chair. I pace the apartment. Should I leave? Where would I go? To my old place? Maybe David is still there. But what are the odds? He's probably living in Gramercy with some non-insane wife. Maybe if I tell him what's going on, he'll know how to fix it. He'll forgive me for whatever I did to get us here. Me in this apartment with a stranger and him on the other side of the bridge. He's the best problem solver. He'll figure it out. I get up and head toward the door. I need to get out of here to escape whatever feeling is flooding this room. Where do I keep my coats? Hey, Aaron says. Where are you going? Think fast.
Just the deli, I say.
The deli? Aaron gets up and comes over to me. Then he puts his hands on my face, right up against either cheek. His hands are cool, and for a moment the temperature change and motion shocks me, and I make a move to reel back, but he holds me in place. Stay. Please don't leave right now. He looks at me, and his eyes are liquid, open. So this is what this guy has on me, this feeling. It's new and familiar all at once. It's heavy, weighted. It sits all around us, and despite myself, I want to stay. Okay, I whisper, because his skin is still on mine, and his eyes are still looking at me. And while I don't understand why I've committed to spend my life with this man, I do know that the bed we share and gets a lot of action because this is big. I feel its resonance in my body. The reverberations of some kind of seismic tidal wave. Outside, the sky turns. He heads toward the bed, holding my hand, and I follow. The wine has started to make me feel languid. I want to stretch out. I perch on the edge of the bed.
5 years, I mutter. Aaron just looks at me. He sits back against the pillows. Hey, he says, can you come here? But it's not a question. Not really. Not insofar as it only has one rhetorical answer. He holds his arms open and out, and I ease onto the bed. I can feel it, this tug on my limbs, like I'm a marionette being pulled unevenly forward toward him. God help me, I let him hold me. He pulls me to him, and I feel his breath warm near my cheek. His face hovers close. Here we go. He's going to kiss me. Am I going to let him? Oh, I think about it. About David and about this Aaron's muscled arms. But before I can weigh the pros and cons and come to a solid conclusion, his lips are on mine. They land gently and he holds them there, delicately, as if he knows, as if he's letting me get used to him. And then he uses his tongue to open my mouth slowly. Oh my God. I'm melting. I've never felt anything like this. Not with David, not with Ben, the only other guy I dated seriously, not even with Anthony, the study abroad fling I had in Florence. This is something else entirely. He kisses and touches like he's inside my brain. I mean, I'm in the future. Maybe he is. You sure you're okay? He asks me, and I respond by pulling him closer. He threads his hands under my sweatshirt, and then it's off before I even realize it, the cool air hitting my bare skin. Am I not wearing a bra? I'm not wearing a bra. He bends and takes one of my nipples into his mouth. This is insane! I'm insane! I've lost my mind! It feels so good. The rest of the clothes come off. From somewhere, a different stratosphere, I hear a car horn honk, a train rumble, the city carry on. He kisses me harder. We get horizontal quickly. Everything feels incredible. His hands tracing the curves of my stomach, his mouth on my neck. I've never had a one-night stand up until this point, but this has to count, right? We met barely an hour ago, and now we're about to have sex. I can't wait to tell Bella about this. She'll love it. But what if I never make it back? What if this guy is just my fiancé now and not a stranger, and I can't even share the details of this wild and... He presses his thumb down into the crease of my hip, and all thoughts of time and space escape through the slightly cracked window. Aaron, I say. Yes. He rolls on top of me. And then my hands are finding the muscles in his back, the crevices of his bones like terrain knotted and wooden and peaceful. I arch against him, this man who is a stranger, but somehow something else entirely. His hands cut my face. They run down my neck. They wrap around my rib cage. His mouth is urgent and seeking against mine. My fingers grip his shoulders. Slowly, and then all at once, I forget where I am. All I'm aware of are Aaron's arms wrapped tightly around me. Chapter 4. I wake up with a jolt, grasping at my chest.
Hey, hey, a familiar voice says. You're awake.
I look up to see David standing over me, a bowl of popcorn in one hand. He's also holding a bottle of water. Not exactly the wine I was just drinking.
Just drinking?
I look down at my body, still fully clothed in my red Reformation ensemble.
What the hell just happened?
I scramble up to sitting. I'm back on the couch. David is now in his chess team tournament sweatshirt and black sweatpants. We're in our apartment.
I thought you might be down for the count, David says, and miss our big night. I knew that second bottle would do us in. I already took two Advil. Do you want some?
He sets the popcorn and the water down and leans over to kiss me.
Should we call our parents now or tomorrow? You know they're all losing it. I told everyone beforehand.
I parse through what he's saying. I'm frozen. It must have been a dream, but
how could it be? I was just 3 minutes ago in bed with someone named Aaron. We were kissing and his hands were on me and we were having the most intense sex of my life. Dream me slept with a stranger. I feel the need to touch my body to confirm my physical reality. I put a hand on each elbow and hold my arms to my chest. You okay? David asks. He's pulled himself out of the jovial moment and is looking at me intently. How long was I out for? I ask him. About an hour, he says. Something dawns on him. He leans closer to me. The proximity of his body feels like an intrusion. Hey, listen, you're going to get that job. I can tell you're stressed about it. And maybe this was too much to have happen in one day. But there's no way they don't hire you. You're the perfect candidate, Danny. I feel like asking him, what job? The food came, he says, sitting back. I stuck it in the fridge. I'll get plates. I shake my head. I'm not hungry. David looks at me with shock and awe. How is that possible? You told me you were weak with hunger like an hour ago. He stands up and goes into the kitchen, ignoring me. He opens the refrigerator and starts pulling out containers. Pad Thai, chicken curry, fried rice. All your favorites, he says. Hot or cold? Cold, I say. I pull the blanket closer around me. David comes back balancing the containers on plates. He starts taking off tops and I smell the sweet and sour and tangy spices. I had the craziest dream, I tell him. Maybe if I talk about it, it'll make sense. Maybe if I lay it all out here, outside of my brain. I can't shake it. Was I talking in my sleep? David piles some noodles onto a plate and grabs a fork. Nope, don't think so. I showered for a little, so maybe. He jams a giant bite of pad thai into his mouth and chews. Some stray noodles migrate to the floor. Was it a nightmare? I think about Aaron. No, I say. I mean, not exactly. David swallows. Good. Your mom called twice. I'm not sure how long we can hold her off. David puts his fork down and threads his arm around me. But I had some plans for us alone tonight. My eyes dart to my hand. The ring, the right one, is back on my finger. I exhale. My phone starts buzzing. Bella again, David says somewhat wearily. I'm already off the couch, snatching the phone and taking it with me into the bedroom. I'm gonna flip on the news, David calls after me. I close the door behind me and pick up the call. Bells?
I waited up!
It's loud where she is. The sound of people fills the phone. She's out partying. She laughs, her voice a cascade of music.
You're engaged! Congratulations! Do you like the ring? Tell me everything.
Are you still in Paris? I ask her.
Yes, she says.
When are you coming home?
I'm not sure, she says. Jacques wants to go to Sardinia for a few days.
Ah, Jacques. Jacques is back. If Bella woke up 5 years in the future in a different apartment, she probably wouldn't even blink. In December?
It's supposed to be quiet and romantic.
I thought you were going to the Riviera with Ronaldo.
Well, he bailed and then Jacques texted that he was in town and voila, new plans.
I sit down on my bed. I look around. The tufted gray chairs I bought with my first paycheck at Clarknell. The oak dresser that was a hand-me-down from my parents' place. The Bakelite lamps David brought with him from his Turtle Bay bachelor pad. I see the expanse of that loft in Dumbo, the blue velvet chairs. Hey, I say, I have to tell you something kind of crazy.
Tell me everything, she hollers through the phone,
and I imagine her spinning out in the middle of a dance floor on the roof of some Parisian hotel, Jacques tugging at her waist. I'm not sure how to explain it. I fell asleep and I wasn't dreaming. I swear I was in this apartment and this guy was there. It was so real, like I really went there. Has anything like that ever happened to you?
No, darling, we're going to the Marais.
What?
Oh, sorry, everyone in the crowd is absolutely starving and it's practically light out. We've been partying for decades. So, wait, it was like a dream? Did he do it on the terrace or in the restaurant?
I hear an explosion of sound and then a door shut. A retreat to silence. Oh, the restaurant, I say. I'll tell you everything when you're back.
I'm here, she says.
You're not, I say, smiling. Be safe, okay? I can see her rolling her eyes.
Do you know that the French don't even have a word for safety?
That is not even remotely true, I say.
Beaucoup.
It's pretty much one of the only French words I know.
Even so, she says, I wish you had more fun.
I have fun, I say.
Let me guess. David is now watching CNN Live and you're wearing a face mask. You just got engaged.
I touch my fingers to my cheek. Only dry skin here.
How was the job interview? She asks. I didn't forget. I just temporarily forgot.
It was great. Honestly, I think I got it.
Of course you got it. You not getting it would require a rip in the universe that I'm not sure is scientifically possible.
I feel my stomach tighten.
Boozy brunch when I'm back, she says.
The door opens again and sound rushes back in through the phone. I hear her kiss someone twice. You know I hate brunch, I say.
But you love me.
She hangs up in a whirlwind of noise. David comes into the bedroom, his hair rumpled. He takes off his glasses and rubs the bridge of his nose. You tired? He asks me. Not really, I say. Yeah, me neither. He climbs into bed, reaches for me. But I can't. Not right now. I'm just going to get some water, I say. Too much champagne. Do you want some water too? Sure, he yawns. Do me a favor and get the light. I get up and flip the light switch. I walk back into the living room, but instead of pouring a glass of water, I go to the windows. The TV is off and it's dark, but the streets are flooded with light. I look down. Third Avenue is busy even now, well past midnight. There are people out, laughing and screaming, heading to the bars of our youth. Joshua Tree, Mercury Bar. They'll dance to 90s music they're too young to really know well into the morning. I stand there for a long time. Hours seem to pass. The streets quiet down to a New York whisper. By the time I go back into the bedroom, David is fast asleep. Chapter 5. I get the job. Of course I do. They call me a week later and offer it, a fraction below my current salary. I argue them up, and by January 8th, I'm giving my 2 weeks' notice. David and I move to Gramercy. It happens a year later, almost down to the day. We find a great unfurnished sublet in the building we've always admired. We'll stay until something opens to buy, David tells me. A year later, something opens to buy, and we buy it. David begins working at a hedge fund started by his ex-boss at Tishman. I get promoted to senior associate. 4.5 years pass. Winters and falls and summers. Everything goes according to plan. Everything. Except that David and I don't get married. We never set a date. We say we're busy, which we are. We say we don't need to until we want kids. We say we want to travel. We say we'll do it when the time is right, and it never is. His dad has heart trouble 1 year. We move the next. There are always reasons, and good ones too, but none of them are why. The truth is that every time we get close, I think about that night, that hour, that dream, that man. And the memory of it stops me before I've started. After that night, I went to therapy. I couldn't stop thinking about that hour. The memory was real, like I had in fact lived it. I felt like I was going crazy, and because of that, I didn't want to talk to anyone, not even Bella. What would I say? I woke up in the future, where I had sex with a stranger? The worst thing is, Bella would probably believe me. I know that therapists are supposed to help you figure out whatever insanity is lingering in your brain, and then help you get rid of it, so the following week I went to someone on the Upper West Side. Highly recommended. In New York, all the best shrinks are on the Upper West Side. Her office was bright and friendly, if not a little sterile. There was one giant plant. I couldn't figure out if it was fake or not. I never touched it. It was on the other side of the sofa behind her chair, and it would have been impossible to get to. Dr. Christine, one of those professionals who uses their first name with their title to seem more relatable. She didn't. She wore swaths of Eileen Fisher, linens and silks and cotton spun so excessively, I had no idea what her shape even was. She was 60, maybe. "What brings you in today?" she asked me. I had been in therapy once after my brother died. A fatal drunk driving accident 15 years ago that had the police show up at our house at 1:37 in the morning. He wasn't the one at the wheel. He was in the passenger seat. What I heard first were my mother's screams. My therapist had me talk about him, our relationship, and then draw what I thought the accident might have looked like, which seemed condescending for a 12-year-old. I went for a month, maybe more. I don't remember much except that afterward my mom and I would stop for ice cream, like I was 7 and not nearly 13. I often didn't want any, but I always got 2 scoops of mint chocolate chip. It felt important to play along then and for a long time after. "I had a strange dream," I said. "I mean, something strange happened to me." She nodded. Some of the silk slipped. "Would you like to tell me about it?" I did. I expressed to her that David and I had gotten engaged, that I'd had too much champagne, that I'd fallen asleep, and that I'd woken up in 2025 in a strange apartment with a man I'd never met before. I left out that I slept with him. She looked at me for a long time once I stopped talking. It made me uncomfortable. "Tell me more about your fiancé." I was immediately relieved. I knew where she was headed with this. I was unsure about David, and therefore my subconscious was projecting a kind of alternative reality where I was not subject to the burdens of what I had just committed to in getting engaged. "He's great," I said. "We've been together for over 2 years. He's very driven and kind. He's a good match." She smiled then, Dr. Christine. "That's wonderful," she said. "What do you think he'd say about this experience you're describing?" I didn't tell David. I couldn't, obviously. What would I possibly say? He'd think I was crazy, and he'd be right. He'd say it was a dream and that I'm stressed out about work. "Would that be true?" "I don't know," I said. "That's why I'm here." "It seems to me," she said, "that you're unwilling to say this was just a dream, but you're not sure what it would mean if it wasn't." What else could it possibly be? I genuinely wanted to know where she was going with this. She sat back in her chair. "A premonition, maybe? A psychosomatic trip? Those are just other words for dreams." She laughed. She had a nice one. The silk slipped again. "Sometimes unexplainable things happen."
"Like what?"
She looked at me. Our time was up. After our session, I felt strangely better. Like in going there, I could see the whole thing for what it was. Crazy. I could give the whole weird dream to her. It was her problem now, not mine. She could file it with all her divorces, sexual incompatibilities, and mother issues. And for 4.5 years, I left it there.